You're listening to Face Off, Episode 12, recorded March 28th, 2009.
Face Off! You're listening to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Mark Sanborn.
And I'm Jade Robbins.
And we will be talking about various aspects of web technology, such as web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. As always, you can view our show notes at faceoffshow.com or follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/faceoffshow.
Face off show. I get stuff. It's a mouthful at the end. So how's it going, Mark? We're here for episode 11. This is episode 12.
It goes by fast.
I know. Holy cow. Sitting here enjoying my my Red Bull Cola.
Red Bull Cola. Yeah, that's some weird stuff.
Yeah, actually, I don't know.
It's all like natural ingredients, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's like a cola. It doesn't really have a whole lot of, I think it's not like so much an energy drink. I think it really is supposed to be a cola, but it's got like all kinds of natural ingredients. Like it's just water and carbon dioxide, sugar, not corn syrup, and like a whole bunch of different spices and stuff like that. So it's really cool. You can like taste the cola. It reminds me of, if you've ever had anybody like homebrew root beer, like make home root beer or home cola and stuff. It's what it is. I mean, cola originally was like just a lot of different spices in sugary water for people to drink. And so it's always pretty good. I don't know. We're energy drink fiends, Mark and I, and we're trying to find an energy drink called Brain Tonic in town. And we drove everywhere, and finally we found this instead.
Found Brain Tonic, but they were out, so we couldn't try it.
It's like it was almost taunting us, this label saying Brain Tonic, and it was like with all these other ones that did not look very good at all. So I don't know, but
What I like about it is like they don't, like, instead of saying just like caffeine, like a lot of these ones, it'll say like caffeine from like coffee beans, like you know, cinnamon, lemon. You know, there's no like sodium benzenate or like, you know, these weird phosphates and. So
I'm trying to improve my health. I'm trying to do it through the internet. So it's kind of a cool experiment where I told all the people on Twitter and on my blog and stuff that, you know, try and help me get healthy, like bug me, annoy me as much as you can, make me feel guilty for doing unhealthy things. So this is kind of a nice thing.
It's a healthy
drink. I don't know. Yeah, it's not healthy, but at least I know and understand every ingredient in it. So hopefully it'll work out. But I'm gonna take a drink right now.
All right,
so let's dig into it, Mark. So the first little bit of news and follow-up I want to talk about is the White House is actually using Google Apps. They're using a tool called Google Moderator for their town hall meetings.
I know you've mentioned that before when we talked about like the that app that sends out the link to people for meetings.
It's lost on me, but
Doodle.
That's what it was. Oh, for meeting times. I thought you were talking about the one that tracked if people clicked your URL for a meeting or not.
Oh.
It was before we did Cligs. It was another one. But okay, it's like
you
Google.
Mentioned it when we talked about, I believe, about moderator. You can send people questions or something. Explain that.
Yeah, so I'm going to talk a little bit about Google Moderator. It's basically a really tool that helps like places where people are going to be asking a lot of questions or there's going to be a lot of discussion. It basically is a social way for people to vote up or down on what questions they want to talk about or what ones want to be asked.
Okay. So it's kind of a polling system, would you say?
Well, it's kind of like a dig for questions. Like people submit all the different questions that, you know, even like let's say a conference where you're going to have a roundtable discussion or something. People submit all the questions that they want asked, and then everyone else gets to like sort of dig up or down questions so that the questions that the most people want answered actually get answered. As opposed to having like, you know, sometimes there's in a meeting or something, there's going to be one person who's just the loudest person. So they tend to get all their questions asked. Well, this is a way for everyone to vote on which questions, you know, so you might go on and be like, oh, well, I want this question asked. You're like, oh, but that's a good question, too. I want that answer, too. So you can kind of vote it up.
So this is actually perfect for what the White House is going to be doing.
Yeah, exactly. These town hall things that they're doing, it lets everyone, you know, on the internet submit questions because it's doing like a. Like a town hall, like a YouTube internet town hall meeting. It's not like an actual town hall. It's like the internet town hall. And so, you know, anyone from the internet can submit questions and then everyone can vote them up. And the questions of you know, our e-generation should hopefully get answered.
Now, a normal person can't just go, or I should say, you can't just go and sign up for this moderator. You have to be part of the Google Apps, right? Like you got to have a Google App server or something? Or how does this, how do I, how does one start a moderator?
It depends, I'm not sure. there's different levels of Google apps. There's like the free Google apps, such as I use for my website. Mm-hmm. There's enterprise and educational versions and stuff. I'm not sure if moderator's in the free one, but
well, it said it was free to people that are using Google apps. I don't know. I'm not sure what level of Google apps, but it says that it is.
Well, that would
free for
that
organizations using Google apps. So
yeah, so anybody can. That's cool.
That's cool.
So it kind of makes me wonder. We've talked a lot about user voice, and this could be
similar thing.
It's pretty similar. User voice is pretty specific in what it wants.
So can you kind of like embed it on your site and have people come in and vote on questions that need to be answered? Or?
I'm not sure if you can embed it in your site. Google really wants you to use apps with apps. So I know if you can embed it in a Google site that you create with Google Sites. You can link to it, no problem. But you couldn't embed it. So it's pretty cool. I'm glad to see the Obama administration is embracing technology. Mm-hmm. And trying to, you know, utilize as much as possible. It actually makes you feel like some people in charge are actually listening to our generation.
Well, that, and I guess, I mean, people can vote and say, this is an important question. I want you to answer this one versus this, you know, these other 20 questions or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. So that's cool. Kudos to them. Kudos to people for using technology in ways they should. I think it's a good idea. All right. So what do we got next? The next thing I want to talk about, it's kind of a mix. This is a kind of a news item / web app. I use a web app called Mebo. Do you use Mebo?
That's the chat, the IM, right?
Yeah, what Built Mebo is a web-based multi-protocol instant messaging client. So instead of having to install Pigeon or Adium on your computer, you go to Mebo.com, you sign up for a Mebo account, you put in all your different accounts information, and when you log on, it logs into all your different instant messaging accounts you can chat with people on. Google Talk, MSN, AOL Instant Messenger. They even have MySpace, Facebook Chat, quite a bit of stuff.
So you'd use this like if you're on a public computer or something, maybe?
That's primarily what I use it for.
Couldn't install like Pigeon or...
Yeah, or sometimes you just don't want to. I have a love-hate relationship with Pigeon. Sometimes I'm really, really happy with it, and then sometimes it just, for like months, it'll crash and I get mad at it. So
yeah, I kind of don't use it anymore. I use... Empathy, which is the GNOME, the one that comes with GNOME now.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. But I was a big fan of Pigeon, but it does the same thing. It's not a big deal, but it doesn't crash as much.
So Mebo is a really cool company. I guess they really are trying to figure out a good way to advertise. They do a lot of, there's a lot of ads on their site, but they're really good ads. It's sort of really good. Smart ads that fit the crowd. They're like they do a lot of food ads, which I've always said I think is the future of the internet. A lot of web services want to do ads on other web services because you can measure like, okay, I click on this and this person came to my website. That's a measurable way to pay people for letting me advertise on their site. Mm-hmm. And I think that food like fast food and stuff needs to look at the internet because it's harder to measure how effective it is, but I think it'll be just, if not even more effective than television ads.
Yeah, well, you can measure it, and you can actually target certain ads, whereas television, you just have to put it in.
Even if I'm not even saying, like, bring people to the Burger King website. I'm saying just advertising Burger King food, people will buy Burger King food. It'll get them hungry. And unlike TV where you watch a show and then there's an ad, usually ads are kind of constantly on us all the time. So I think food will catch on. And Mebo seems to know that. They advertise a lot more food or more grocery supermarket products and things like that. Things that have companies that have been sort of reluctant to do ads on the web in the past because it's hard to measure its effectiveness. But they're really forward thinking. And so I guess the news item with this is that Mebo did a new thing where they integrated your ad into the background of the website. So before you've been able to customize your background on the website. You can put your own background but what they've done now is they made the entire background this really sort of subtle advertisement. And the really good news is that their users seem to not mind it. They, in fact, like it.
Well, yeah, I mean, it kind of blends in. I'm looking at the example they've got here, and it's kind of transparent in the background.
Exactly.
It's not
a good
pop-up ad.
Yeah, exactly.
Like...
I mean, and I think this is a good idea because advertisers will start looking at, rather than being in your face, which are the ads that really annoy us, ads that pop over your whole screen, throw them in the background. Make them subtle ads. Make them almost, like they slip into your mind without even knowing.
You know, the other one that kind of does this, but not quite like this, is Pandora.
Pandora does it a lot, too. Yeah, they do it in the background. In Pandora, it's pretty loud, but it's nice that it's kind of just integrated into the theme in the background.
Right.
But again, there's another company that is thinking about ads. Like for a while they're doing a lot of Wendy's ads on Pandora, and it works. I mean, I love food, you know that. And so, I mean, if I'm at work listening to Pandora and it was like the new Baconator, and I was like, oh, I love bacon. I want to, you know, and it works.
Bacon's bad for you. Trying to.
I know. I'm gonna drink my Red Bull soda that's natural and healthy right now.
Healthier.
That's the key. But so Meebo's really cool. What's nice about it is, I mean, if you want, like what I do is, I set it up a long time ago. I put in all my accounts and I don't have to touch it. But when I need it, it works and it's there. I go to Meebo.com. I log in. You know, a lot of times, just, you know, like you said, public computers, things like that. I can go instant message and get all my protocols, not just go to like the Google Talk mobile page, you know, or the MSN mobile page. I get them all in one spot.
Yeah. And I'm not sure that Pigeon or any of the IM clients that I've ever used integrate Facebook and some of those other apps you were talking about.
Pigeon has a Facebook
plugin.
It crashed Pigeon a lot. Oh. So I gave up on it. Plus, this might be a good discussion, Facebook chat. When Facebook chat first rolled out, I was really excited. I was really impressed. I thought, this is going to be a great service.
Was it kind of like the Gmail chat? Because I've never used the Facebook.
Yeah. It's in Facebook's page, in browser.
Okay.
And when you log into Facebook, it puts you as live, and people chat. It kind of pops up in the corner, okay. Really subtle. But what the thing I found was, I guess I'm pretty particular who I instant message to regularly.
Yeah.
But I'm really not particular about who I add as friends on Facebook. Because, I mean, I have some pretty distant relatives. I have friends from junior high that didn't go to high school, you know. But I'll add them, let them see what's going on.
Right.
Why not?
Kind of like Twitter, you follow people that you don't even know. Or...
Yeah, oh yeah. Or anyway, you know, I'm not going to block people on Twitter, you know.
Right.
But when they start instant messaging me, that's kind of when I drew the line a little bit. I thought, you know, I'll let you look at my information, but if you expect to have like a 2-hour conversation with me just because I'm your friend on Facebook, I'm not cool with that.
Yeah.
So I actually disabled Facebook chat on the Facebook webpage.
Somebody tries it, it just says, oh, this user doesn't have this installed.
Well, actually, I mean, I set my status as always offline.
Oh. Okay.
So, and it remembers that whenever I log in Facebook. Just think about who you're instant messaging if you're on Facebook chat. You know, if it's someone that you probably wouldn't have an extensive face-to-face conversation with, you probably don't want to do instant messaging.
I would go as far as to say get on Twitter and just do replies because it's a little bit less formal than I am, and you can kind of respond when
that's
you want
to. That's why Twitter is really nice like that. It's like a public instant message that's not formalized. It's not engaged.
Yeah, you don't have to worry about somebody, you know, breaking up your work, you know, right? You're in the middle of something and they're trying to have a conversation with you or whatever. You can just reply when you get a chance.
Yeah.
It's kind of like email, but email is a little bit formal still.
Yeah, I mean, there's some people I really mesh well with on instant message. Like you and I think instant message really well. We, you know, we know each other's work habits. So, you know, if you leave for 15 minutes, I don't freak out.
Right.
You know, I just know that you tend to, you know, you go work on something else for 15 minutes away from your desk. You can't, you know, and some people don't get that. Like if and I'm the same way at work. Like if my boss calls me in for a meeting, you know, ad hoc, I have to take it. And you know not to freak out. Sometimes I come back and people are like, where are you at? Oh, we were in the middle of a conversation. And it's like, well, I'm at work. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I'm not going to, you know. So I don't know. All right. So let's move on to the next little web app. Kind of web app. Kind of not. I don't know what classifies a web app. But this is moo.com. MOO.com. And it's a great website to print business cards. They do other printing thing, but like sort of their milieu is business cards. So
okay.
What's cool about this, though, is it's a single price point, and it's like fairly cheap, but they do color front and back. And you do all the design on the web. You upload a picture. And so like on the back, you can upload a picture that'll cover the entire back of your business card. And on the front, you can have kind of like a little side sliver image. Full color, and it's, you know, I think they're actually in the UK, but
London.
It takes a week or so to get them to you, but like you can get it. What's nice, you can get like 20 cards. You can
really
get 50. You know, you can get, or I think 50. I think is the bare minimum. 50 for like $20, and then or like, you know, 100. They have these little half cards. They're like space saver cards. They're I think a third of a normal business card size.
Wow,
and you can get like 100 of those for $20, and they have full color back.
Wow.
Yeah, so, I mean, I was looking at it before our little Bozeman tweet off because I wanted to get some business cards made with, you know, Face-Off's web address on them or something to pass out.
So these are, I mean, this is pretty, this is a lot of colors. This isn't just like four color process or something. This is like photograph style.
No, yeah, full color front full back.
Full color, yeah. So probably, probably not just like process four color, probably CMYK or
One of the other ones. You know, some printing companies are classic. Traditionally, when you order business card, printing companies are like, well, if you had another color, that's going to be another, buttload of money. And when so I told you I was going to get business cards, the first thing you said was like, well, get multiple, estimates because, but this is good because it's just, you know, straightforward. You can get a low volume of cards for like freelancers or people doing consulting like us to hand out to people. And I think it's good for me. Like I'm working on my personal brand. So if I wanted cards for work, like my job, you know, they should provide that. But this is, you know, a way for me to put out my name with, you know, my brand and my URL.
Yeah, it looks like they do stickers and all kinds of stuff. And I mean, especially if you're a web guy or a freelancer guy, your business cards are going to look good if they're, you know, designed well with lots of colors and things.
Exactly.
So you're not going to want to just, no, I want three, four colors or whatever.
Yeah, and it'll make you stand out. It's not, you know, the same business card everyone sees, corporate logo on the side and your name. I mean, like on the back, you have a full color image over the whole card.
Mm-hmm.
And like for me, it was great because I have sort of my vector portrait that you and I made together that I'm kind of trying to establish as, you know, maybe my e-brand. I have it as my avatar and everything. And so I made that like the image on the whole back. And then I made kind of just a sliver of that image as the picture on the front.
Are you familiar with Color Lovers, the website?
No. What is that?
Well, let's just might as well talk about I mentioned it. So pull it up. What it is you can input certain patterns or tags or keywords or whatever for colors, and it'll give you palettes of colors to use.
Oh, okay. I think we use this.
Yeah.
This is the one that we use.
This is the one that I've linked to you before. Now it looks like this moo.com integrates Color Lovers for their business cards. So you can it looks like they've got packs of, let me see. Whoops. These palettes here, you've got all the different colors. And so you don't have to get full color to still get like a good palette of colors. And you can, Color Lovers. So let's kind of talk about that a little bit.
I'll give my use case for Color Lovers, why I used it.
Okay.
I think this was the website, wasn't it? Where you can upload an image.
Yeah, I believe so.
Okay. I think
they do that too. They do a bunch of different things for colors. Yeah.
So where I use this website, I think it's really handy for us, is I made the vector image of myself, which, I'm wearing kind of a red football hat. And then, I kind of have a brownish, reddish color beard and blue eyes and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The image that I used to make my vector image sort of dictated the colors. So I used the colors of the image to make this vector image of myself. And then I kind of gave it like a brown or an orange background. I wanted orange for some reason. And then what I did is I went to Color Lovers, I uploaded that image, and it gives you, I think, like an 8-color palette of colors directly from that image to use in your website. And this was great because it gives me the colors, it gives me the hex code for it, so I can put it in my CSS.
Uh-huh.
So from Color Lovers, I was able to create a palette for my website. So, you know, I made my brand. I said, this is, you know, I like this vector image. We made these. I think it's pretty cool. And from there, it pulled out all the colors for my, you know, my hyperlinks, my H1s, my borders, everything.
Yeah.
You know?
The other thing, too, is it can actually do suggestions. Like, and say, oh, this color, actually, we found that these other people like this color with this other color that you've got in your vector logo. And so then you can add more colors or whatever that mesh together, that blend together well.
Yeah.
Based on other people's choices.
Yeah.
So you're not just making a guess saying, oh, I think I like this color with this one, you know. So it's a pretty cool tool for people that are looking for colors to use on their website.
Yeah, yeah. It's a really cool website. It's
a real common mistake for some developers is to have a ton of different colors on the screen.
Yeah. Yeah, you get excited about it.
Yeah, if you look at a lot of really well-done designs, they usually stick to a very small palette of colors.
Yeah, this is a really cool website. I mean, you can do so much with it. I love it.
But anyways, it looks like this Moo card uses their kind of system for helping you pick colors. So
That's awesome.
That's cool.
I like these guys.
So you can tell it's a little bit, it's more of a technology kind of printing instead of just a traditional printing
and
company.
And hip and trendy sort of thing. Like if people are handing out black and white business cards, traditional good looking business cards, I don't think they look bad. I like them myself. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a pretty traditional guy. That's fine. But when they're handing those out and you hand them, you know, a card with full color and even especially if like you're an artist with some of your work on it, I mean, it's going to stand out like no one's business.
For sure.
And it's a pretty good price. I mean, if you went to a regular copy shop and tried to get those, it'd be pretty pricey for like full color front and back. Mm-hmm. So.
It's like they also have like recycled, you can get like fully recycled paper and stuff if you're a green, you know, an environmentally friendly company or, you know, going green.
Well, and the funny part is it they actually, there is a difference between the recycled paper and the regular paper besides certain things. Like their regular paper is their glossy paper. And recycled paper is like the more matte traditional business card paper. So not only is it, you know, would you get it if you're trying to go green, but you would also get it just because you wanted matte paper.
Right. Yeah. It looks like they kind of show you it's one's kind of glossy laminated versus the regular stock. So
it's cool. Moo.com.
If you're looking for a business card or you're starting your business up or your web app or whatever you want to get people to know about it, you know, maybe get a pack of 20 or 50 and have them shipped over.
Yeah, exactly. I think I'm going to do it in the near future, so I'm excited about that. All right, so our final web app that we want to talk about is this really cool website. I don't know if you know it, Mark. I wouldn't say I'm cheap. I don't think I'm cheap, but I go through these phases. There's certain things I spend money on. I spend money on electronics. I don't like to spend money on food. And this is probably one of the reasons I'm trying to get healthy is, you know, obviously in today's world, healthier food is more expensive. So this might not be the best web app for me right now, but there's a lot of people out there who would love it. It's called 3BuckBytes.com. And what it is a giant sort of database of different food around the United States. I think United States, maybe the world. United States for sure. That is under $3.
Cool.
Yeah, and so what you can do is you can go on there and you can go on there and you can submit different foods. You can and say whether or not you like it. So let's say, you know, here's one. In the Little Paris Coffee Shop in San Francisco, California, there is a barbecue pork sandwich that two people like, and it was posted March 27th. And the comment the guy had, Craig Haig from, you know, City Search San Francisco, said this little lovely from Little Paris Coffee Shop on the lighter side, but definitely could take care of an empty stomach on its own. So it's under $3. All the food on here is under $3. Some of them have caveats. Like I saw one where the lady said, you know, it's under $3 during happy hour at 4 to 6. No big deal. But, you know, I can say, okay, well, I'm going to New York. I am hungry and I don't have a lot of money. Where can I go get something for $3?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just kind of a cool little site. I like the concept of it. It seems to be executed pretty fairly well. There's pictures, which is nice. It's picture heavy, so you're not, you know, someone's going to be like, go get here for this $3, and you're going to get there, and it's going to, you know, not look tasty or anything like that. But
well, I mean, it looks like these are not the pictures you see on a menu. These are people that took the picture themselves.
I think they take the picture on their phone.
That's much better representation. You know, you go to like JV's or something. No. You look at the menu and you're like, that's not what I
ordered. The classic Big Mac in the ad versus Big Mac in real life. I mean, the Big Mac in the ad is, I think, about 6 inches tall. You know, it could stand up to an earthquake. And the one you get, somehow they squish it down to about an inch tall. You've got one bun poking out the side, cheese everywhere, mustard and onions. It's like, it's a mess.
So that, I mean, that's cool that they show like an actual picture. Some of these, I mean, you can, they're actual pictures because like some of the lighting isn't very well. I mean, these aren't professional pictures, which is, I like that because it's actual representation. And I like the social aspect of it. This guy's saying he likes it. This guy's, you know, this is cheap or this is kind of greasy, but it's still good for under three, you know, or something like that. It's a social aspect. It's kind of, this is like, it's like your friend telling you, hey, there's this cool place, you know, and to get this really good, inexpensive food.
And this site's pretty young. So like if you go to the top bite section, like the top one has 54 people that like it. And it's a Sloppy Joe's lunchroom. It's a big, tasty, cheesy Sloppy Joe is delicious comfort food. A great hallowed roll lined with melted cheddar, then filled with sweet Sloppy Joe mix. So,
do you can you sort by state or city?
I think if you go by, if you search, you can search. Because that's exactly what, like, I want to say I'm going to, yeah, so if I go to Three Buck Bite Finder, if you go to search, you can, you know, just go by city.
Yeah, city here.
They don't have every city right now. So, I mean, that sucks. So, well, like, let's say I'm going to Seattle.
Yeah, I want to pick Seattle because I've been there a few times.
You know, let's say late night special. Ooh, I want to look, or just let's look at all. I want to see them all. Specials,
they don't
search.
Have much for Seattle. Like you said, it is new.
It's pretty new, but check it out. I think it's cool. Eventually, I hope that they'll just make it so you can submit it anywhere and not really only have select cities. I think that's kind of silly, but there's a way to find cheap food. And I mean, just because it's cheap doesn't mean it's bad for you too. I mean, there's kind of this assumption that it is, but
their logo is very interesting. All the people.
Yeah. It's like this sort of cartoon drawn food with silhouettes of people that look nude. They appear to be enjoying cheap food in the nude, but, cheap food in the nude. I'm patenting that. I'm keeping that. That's trademark jrobbins.com.
All right.
But, you know, you could submit to become a dictator of an area so that you can make sure people are doing stuff right. It's social.
Oh, that's nice. So it's not one person moderating everything. That's really nice.
Yeah. And I mean, yeah, it looks like right now it's pretty heavily moderated because it's not so big. It's small enough that they can, you know, that people can make sure. Like, if I lived in a city that this was on and someone submitted something and I was the dictator, you can bet I'm going to go try and make sure that that description is accurate. Yeah. For only $3. Why not?
You should sign up to be Bozeman, the first guy.
It'll just be me adding $3 meals around Bozeman. It'll be like 12 of them. Like, this delicious pre-made wrap is full of veggie goodness. So, ThreeBuckBites.com. Hopefully this will take. I think this is a good idea. Especially as, you know, the sort of the economy dips down, people are looking for small stuff and or cheap stuff, I guess. Mm-hmm. I should say. And the nice part about something that's $3 is, you know, you're not going to get a lot of food, which, you know, again, this is like the Jade Robbins health episode. We're going to talk about how to make me healthy. One of my big pushes is portion control. So let's say if I lived in a city and I stuck to $3 bite food, I mean, I'm not going to get anything huge.
No.
Like, you know, I won't get anything big at all, so I can get food that's, you know, the right portion for me.
Mm-hmm.
So check it out, ThreeBuckBite.com. All right, so let's get into some topics, Mark. The first thing I want to talk about, this is kind of a web app, kind of a topic thing.
Yeah, big web app topic, actually.
Yeah. Amazon S3.
Okay, so what Amazon S3 is, well, what it stands for is Simple Storage Service. It's done by Amazon. It's an online web service that you can use for anyone to use, any developers to use in their own web apps, okay? Mm-hmm. This is the same stuff that Amazon uses to run their own stuff. So this is very scalable, very secure, very robust, very professional.
Yeah, we've talked about this before, and I think it's a great model where Google Apps did this. They run Google off Google Apps.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a great thing because not only does it make sure that you add features and good features that people want,
mm-hmm.
it also is a disclaimer for your service. I mean, when the Google guy came to Montana State and he said, you know, Larry and Sergey and Eric Schmidt are not using a different Gmail than you.
There's no secret Gmail.
He said there's no super secret Gmail that's in a.
They literally,
you know,
go to gmail.com and log in with their stuff.
Yeah, they probably go to apps.google.com because there's probably a Google instance of Google Apps, and log in with it and use it themselves. And that's a great disclaimer. I mean, the fact that this is Amazon, and it's a good model for a business too, because if they go through the work of building this good service that works really well for them, and then they can just pipe it out and sell it, why mm-hmm. not, right? I mean, you went through the work of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a good model. I like it.
So basically what this Amazon S3 is, like a storage bucket, all right? So you get this bucket of information. You can do all kinds of stuff with this bucket. You can have permissions. You can make it a private bucket where, you know, you're just storing backups, your company backups online, off-site to Amazon. In that case, you would have very scalable. I mean, you could be going as fast as your connection can handle, you know, offloading your data and storing it. If you're somebody, Twitter actually uses this to store your images.
So does Woot.com. Woot. I noticed they do it to store their product images.
See, and there's been a case study on Wikipedia. They mentioned that there was a company that saved roughly $500,000 a year.
SmugMug.
SmugMug?
SmugMug used it, yeah. And they said the nice part about this, this is not cited, by the way. Just Wikipedia, no. This use case is not cited.
Okay.
But, or actually that one was. I lied. what's nice about it is it says, you know, there's been outages and slowdowns with S3. But again, like if Amazon is using this, if there's an outage or a slowdown, they're losing money.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to get on it right away.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. So you have to pay you have to pay for the storage. You have to pay for the bandwidth going in and out. There's different rates for all that. But here's the thing you have to calculate. You're only calculating per byte that you're moving and storing.
Mm-hmm.
And they have that, you know, they've got that worked out. If you were to do this on your own and create your own system like this, you'd have to have tons of machines to replicate the same thing. And you'd have to hire people to maintain all these machines. So it's really, most companies are finding that Amazon can provide the server cheaper than they could ever build it themselves.
Yeah, it's a cloud service. I mean,
right.
Amazon is specializing in storage of sort of just redundant data. And of course, they're going to be able to do it better than us. That's why Gmail is so good, because Google, of course, can do email better than any of us, you know, goofy little sysadmins at home.
Right.
I mean, they offer services I can never even dream to imagine as or dream to offer as a sysadmin. I think a cloud service like this is great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, well, they have so many computers, so many people that they have economies of scale. They're getting better deals on the computers that you're going to get.
Yeah.
I mean, they just can offer it way cheaper. One of the things is there's no limit on the bandwidth. You don't, it's not something you just sign up. This is a very professional service. I mean, you could say I want to store 5 megabytes a month, or you could be like Dig or someone that says I want to store, you know, 500 terabytes and I want to have 5 million people a second go to see this image, and it's going to work.
Yeah. The cool thing,
you're
about,
not going to be down.
The cool thing about this service is in looking into it, it's being used at sort of all levels of the internet. Big companies like SmugMug and Woot are using them, but also so are little companies and little websites. I mean, mm-hmm. smaller companies are using it as like you said, a backup solution, an offsite backup, you know, because it's just cheap storage, it's the cheapest stuff you can find out on the internet, and it's easy to use and easy to access.
Yeah, there's actually companies, like there's one called Jungle Disk that is like, they provide an application for you to back up your home computer to Amazon S3 storage backend.
Oh, okay.
They've got an API for developers to like send the data back and forth. They've got multiple programs. Perl.com uses it for their entire site. Pretty well, I'm not sure about their entire site, but they do use it for a lot of their site. They've got Perl scripts. They've got an example in here on how to use it in Perl, as well as pretty much every language they've got. And so I went to the Amazon code library for this thing. They've got it. They've got a package called Tarzan for PHP developers, mm-hmm. a toolkit that just basically integrate it. Haskell, C Sharp, I mean, everything. People are using this like crazy. Django's got it. I'm sure Rails has some kind of a plugin to use.
Oh, yeah. I mean, easily. It's
got
pretty,
it. I'm sure
it's pretty full-featured. I mean, it's just redundant file storage, correct? Just like files
that and it's kind of, it's a content distribution network, meaning it's in the Amazon cloud. Like,
yeah,
it doesn't matter if I'm in Florida. Well, they do separate by region. Like Europe is, they have different servers in Europe versus the United States, which is actually an interesting thing. Like, that's another thing is if you were to do this yourself, you'd have to go buy servers in Europe. and push the data over to them. You know, Amazon's already doing this. So why not use their service? They can do it cheaper.
A really cool service that people are really liking is a service called Dropbox.
Okay,
and uses Amazon S3.
Does it?
Yeah, I've heard a lot of people talk about Dropbox. They like it a lot. It's a way to, I mean, it could be a web app we do or an application we use, but it's an application you put on your computers that you drop files into, and every computer you have that's, you know, has your Dropbox on it, you can get the files to it from it.
Cool.
And it uses Amazon S3.
Yeah, so, I pretty much every web app, well, no, not every web app, but a lot of the web apps are using Amazon S3. Like, Everyone, yeah. Most of the ones I use Amazon.
Well, any company who's doing, I mean, especially like Dropbox, this is a great way for a company to offer, you know, a service that is going to deal with a lot of big file transfers, a lot of big files, mm-hmm. a lot of file distribution, and not have to worry about the back end. I mean, you just have to pay for it, and it's cheap. Mm-hmm. It's much cheaper than doing it yourself.
Yeah, for sure. And the other things, cool things you can do too with it is, like, you can say, I want this bucket to be open to the public for the next 30 minutes and then shut it down. Stuff like that. That
wow.
You just, or, you know, make this bucket for 24 hours and then shut it down. or you can have access list control stuff on your buckets. You can say, I want these users to be able to use the bucket, but nobody else. So, yeah.
Wow. I mean, I didn't know this, but this is the first publicly available web service that Amazon launched.
Really?
Like, web service. I mean, you know, they offer, and I don't know, I think they've done a great job with it so far. I think it's a great app. Very cool. I mean, I'd like to use it. It sounds cheap. You and I talked about using it for a backup solution.
Yeah, I don't think it's the best for the backup. I think it's best for, if you've got a good idea on the web with your web app, but you're like, you know, I don't know. What if this thing goes popular? Do I have to buy like a bunch of servers? What do I got to do? You know,
the scalability question we talked about
use
it before.
This. Don't even think about it. I mean, just use this.
Yeah, exactly.
This is gonna be it.
So that's good. That's very cool.
It makes a barrier to entry for getting into making a web app that can scale really easy because you just pay as you go.
Yeah,
as it scales.
Like, I don't want to have to deal with storage. Just personally, it doesn't. Ugh. It seems like a good thing to make a service. Because like a cloud service, because
right. Well, you don't have to buy like 10 machines, you know,
and co-located around the world.
Add another one as you scale. Add another machine, and have all the problems, and hire people to run the machines. And
yeah, when Amazon has all the infrastructure, all the know-how.
And at least at first, I mean, if you get to the point where you're humongous, then you might not be able. You might not need them, but
I'd still trust Amazon. I don't know about you.
that's huge though. So
yeah, Amazon is huge.
I mean, Twitter is still using Amazon S3.
Yeah. So I mean,
Amazon's really great service, and it lowers the barrier to entry to do things
like that Dropbox app. I mean, that's a really good app people mm-hmm. like, and it's an easy cost to translate onto your customers. Let's say if you do have like a premium service, I mean, it's one of those things where you can sort of take the risk of saying like, well, I'm going to charge them X amount a month, and some months I'll come out ahead, some months I won't, because, you know, the Amazon Dropbox price will go up and down depending on usage. Or you could just, you know, pass the usage cost directly onto them as a variable cost each month or whatever you want to do.
And some people, well, it's a good thing you brought up, like the cycles. Like, your site could have like almost no traffic, and then the next day all of a sudden it got dug or whatever, and you're getting millions of people on your new web app that you just built. You're either going to need to do something quick like this, just add it real quick, or you're going to have a site that's down.
Yeah, exactly.
So
very cool. All right, that was Amazon S3. The next thing we want to talk about, and so kind of a disclaimer, I guess, for our listeners. Neither Mark nor I have ever used this next thing we're going to talk about, but we're both kind of curious and kind of have looked at it and think we might play with it, and that is Adobe Flex.
All right. So from what I've heard so far, Adobe Flex is a way to build Flash applications without using like a Flash editor.
Yeah, I mean, that's
like
what
you use a scripting language?
Yeah, like XML or something? It's almost like you, and it's basic functionality. You're not going to use Flex to create Homestar Runner, but you could use Flex to create something like Groove Shark. You know, it has a lot of user interface elements, some like simple movement stuff, but like not really advanced animation. It's a way to make a Flash application with a lot of sort of common UI elements. There's sort of pre-built canned UI elements that you can put into this, all done with scripting, so that you don't have to have Flash.
So you could make like a Pandora or a Groove Shark or like something with a somewhat similar interface, but it just...
Yeah, I mean, you're not... Like, Pandora's complexity is on the back end. Its front end doesn't do a whole lot. It's like, oh, there's buttons, things slide out, no big
play
deal.
And that's about it.
Yeah, so it's good for things like... I think Groove Shark is made with Flex. I have a feeling, and that seems like a perfect application where you could script, you know, another row element with this title in it, another row element with this title in it, another row element, you know, this sort of div or box or whatever. When you click this button, it slides out. You know, simple sort of UI Flash applications.
I've actually never done any Flash. Is it mainly a GUI drag and drop kind of thing with programming on the other side? Because I'm pretty sure you have to do Flash within the Adobe products, right, to even build a Flash application, right?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know. I think so, but you don't have to with this.
Well, yeah,
right?
I think that's what people are liking about the Flex, is you don't have to do that.
Yeah, and so, I mean, I'm not sure. I haven't messed with Flash enough. I've played around with it, like simple animation, but there almost seems to be two parts to Flash. Like the graphical, you know, animations, UI stuff, and then all this hardcore backend stuff, which I think like might use, you know, maybe ColdFusion or something. I don't know. Adobe stuff I don't know as well as I should, but I've heard a lot of good things about Flex. A lot of people like Flex, and it seems to be that it kind of closes that barrier to entry of having a, you know, $5,000 Adobe suite to do it with, or, you know, what is Flash, like $200?
Yeah.
You know, something like that, just for Flash by itself. You know, you don't have to have that now.
Okay.
The question is, though, I mean, do you then compile this into, like, a SWF file, or, I mean, is it done with handlers on the back end, or, I mean, what happens?
I think it's kind of like an API to the Flash, because it's saying it uses MXML and XML-based markup language. You're basically just telling Flash what to do, and it kind of makes it
up. Okay, so you like kind of include a basic, let's say, Flash SWF that, you know, the Flex SWF, and then it reads the scripting language. It kind of does it from there.
I think so.
That sounds cool. I kind of want to, you know, I'd like to play around with that a little bit.
So what other companies like, so JavaFX is the Java version kind of what this kind of does. Okay. I wouldn't say it's exactly the same, but I'm saying that's kind of what their implementation of this sort of technology is. Windows or Microsoft's version is kind of like the Silverlight.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Okay. So just as a comparison, if anybody knows any of those other technologies.
I don't know. I mean, they say like Yahoo Messenger for the web uses Flex. I don't know. I guess this is one of those moments where I would like to say, I mean, I'm interested in it. And I mean, if anybody has any experience with it or anything, we'd love to talk to someone about it.
Yeah. I mean, we're definitely going to do a follow up on it as soon as we get some more technology, you know, some more experience with it. But it's kind of new. I mean, it's fairly new. It's a fairly new thing. So
I don't think it's super new, but it's definitely started gaining steam. I've heard.
Well, that's kind of what I meant.
Yeah,
it's not new.
I've
it's been out since
hearing
like 2004.
About it a lot more. I heard murmurs, people mention it, but it's now to the point where it's getting mainstream. People can hear it. People have heard of it and are using it and thinking about it. So.
Yeah, like we talked about Adobe Air last episode. It's kind of like one of those new things people are using a lot more.
Yeah, exactly. So, can you build an Air app with this?
Good question.
I don't know. I mean, I wonder. Yeah. It makes me curious about it because I don't know. I always thought one of the biggest barrier to entries for anything Flash was that you have to buy the software for it. I mean, luckily, Adobe, I mean, has made it good enough that people have been able to justify purchasing that, you know. But you can do some pretty powerful stuff with Flash. I was pretty anti-Flash, 5 years ago, 5-6 years ago, but seeing all the rich web things that have come out of Flash since then, I'm glad that I was wrong, because I mean the web has been transformed because of Flash.
Yeah. Well, and the good thing about Flash is it's pretty much on every single computer now that people are using YouTube and these apps.
Yeah.
I mean, when you first install, Windows XP or something on a machine, and you try to go to a site, it's almost always saying you need Flash right off the bat.
Yeah, I mean, an ad needs Flash, or some little widget needs Flash, or something always needs Flash.
Yeah, so, I mean, Flash is it's very common, so you can make your sites a little bit more dynamic by adding just a Flash app, and you don't have to worry about the person not being able to see it, because most people have Flash.
Yeah, now that they sort of unified their development for things like Linux, I mean, for a while there was Linux was two versions behind Windows and Mac. And so, and then Flash went through some rapid development for a while there. It was like Flash 6 forever, it seemed like. And then Flash 7 came out, and that kind of became a good standard. And then like 8 and 9 just kind of rolled out really fast. And like everything 7, I mean, no one did anything 7 when 9 came out, and everything required 9. I don't know what 9 put out that was so important, but everything requires 9. So things like the Wii's browser, who has an old version of Flash, Flash 7, is worthless now. Absolutely worthless. You can't go to YouTube. Mm. You can't go to half the things out there because they require new Flash 9 stuff.
Huh. I know Flash 10 broke a lot of copy and paste stuff that 9
is
had in it.
Is Flash 10 out?
I believe so.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
No, yeah, it is out. It's out.
I'm behind the times.
They even have a Flash 10 for Linux.
Wow. Okay, well, I really dropped the ball on that one. I thought Flash 9 was the newest version.
They used to have a lot of apps that integrated, like, the copy and paste. Like, click on this button, and it'll automatically copy this text into your clipboard. They took that out because they're like, you know, we shouldn't probably mess with the clipboard.
Like, security hazard.
Yeah, yeah. But a lot of people were kind of upset about that.
I think that's a useful feature. I wish they wouldn't have.
Maybe you could turn it on. I don't know. Huh. I think they just took it out completely.
Yeah,
I could see it should that. Be kind of like the, well, anyways. Adobe Flex is a way to basically make those apps without having to do, I mean, more of a scripting side.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like this is one of those things where you just want Flash for your user interface. You don't want to do too much other stuff. So it's a way to build like kind of a smooth, slick new interface that isn't, you know, strictly web looking. Without having to do hardcore Flash programming, you just do scripting. So, check it out, Adobe Flex. Like we said, if any of our listeners have some experience or more information, or if we're wrong, let us know, and we'd love to have follow up on this.
Right.
So that we can make sure we get it right. Because
it's not that it's new. It is something that is getting steam, and we just wanted to talk about it now, and we'll probably do another follow up on it. So.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things you and I do, we tend to do a lot more back end stuff than front end stuff, like design stuff, Flash stuff. We don't do a whole lot of that at all. I mean, I think I touched Flash for about half a day once in my old job, and other than that, I haven't done any of it. But I'm curious because I think it's something that I should learn and at least, you know, have more of a clue as to what I can do with it.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so. Let's move on. I think we kind of beat that one with a dead horse, I think.
Okay, so the next app.
Or beat it like a dead horse. We didn't beat it with a dead horse.
The next topic we've got here.
All right, so the next thing we're going to talk about is a Python framework called Django, which has been around for a while. But the reason we're going to bring it up is our own Mark Sanborn has taken upon himself to do a little Django. So we're going to pick his brain on that and see what he thinks about it. So Mark, give us a little bit about, we've talked frameworks. I think everybody knows kind of what a framework is. So tell me kind of why Django is different and what you like about it and just some things that you think you want to talk about.
Sure. Okay. So the first thing, I'm kind of the guy that likes to do what's the best thing, this versus that. I want to, you know, what's this versus that? What's the best one? It always comes down to, well, they all have pros, they all have cons, blah, blah, blah. To tell you the truth, I picked Django by flipping a coin.
Wow, that's a very scientific process.
At first. And so, yeah, very.
It was between Django and Rails, correct?
Yes, Django and Rails. I did them both for the same amount of time before I flipped the coin, though. I did Rails for about 2 days going through the tutorials, and I had a book that I was reading. The other thing, well, okay, so I flipped the coin and I decided on Django. The difference is right away, I would say, for somebody that's never done Rails or Ruby language, Ruby is a very odd language.
It's different.
At first.
Yeah, I mean, it's designed to be that way. One of the reasons Ruby was made was to create a language that seemed more natural. So
natural language, yeah.
Yeah, more natural language. Ruby tries to be spoken. It tries to be to sort of flow as a spoken language. Like you could say do, you know.
The thing that I noticed right away with Ruby, the way they do things that made it weird, is no other language that I have currently written software in treated like text as an object that can be then do things.
Mm-hmm. And you didn't like that?
It's strange. I don't know. There's things that I didn't get right away.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And I kind of like was like, you know, should I go with the Ruby that's really different, or should I just go with Python that looks really, really easy to learn?
I guess.
They're both, I don't want to say one's easier to learn than the other, but
Python conforms more to sort of the standard language set that, you know, the sort of C, Java.
Right.
You know.
It was more familiar, I guess. It's more familiar. I don't want to say one's easier to learn. It was more familiar to me in what I've programmed in thus far. With that in mind, I did, though, I was saying, well, I should learn Rails because everybody's doing Rails and it's got a little bit more popularity behind it. So I just said, you know what? I'm just going to flip a coin because they're both great frameworks. I've heard, I mean, Google is behind Django and Python like nobody's business. Mm-hmm. They're all about Python. So they've got big backing there.
Yeah.
The Rails community has, I mean, it's probably the most popular framework. I mean, it's everyone's using Rails, it seems like.
Yeah, there's a lot of Rails out there. It's pretty popular.
One of the things that I kind of noticed when I was going through my phase of, oh, which ones should I learn? Which one's better, you know? Was that Django was kind of more for content-based stuff, and Rails was more for application.
Okay. So explain that a little bit more to me, what you're saying.
Okay, so Django was originally designed for, like, a newspaper article content generation admin backend.
Oh, okay.
Like kind of WordPress. Like, you're going to publish art, like you're going to make articles, I'm going to give this writer certain permissions on these articles and do these things and do this admin.
I see. It's kind of like a CMS. I don't want to say CMS. I don't want to bring that into, but it seems geared more toward putting just content out as opposed to having back-end applications that are running things that work well with the front end.
Yeah, and I want to make a disclaimer. I've written probably 4 hours of Django and 4 or 5 hours of Rails. I'm not a huge Rails or Django guy, you know, so...
These are good, valid observations.
For somebody that's new coming into this, this is what I've seen from other people's posts, is that, you know, it was that thing. Is Rails is more for, like, applications. Like, Rails has a really good migration thing.
Yeah.
To where you can migrate your app, and Django, it has a really strong admin interface back in. Like, it builds the admin interface before, I mean... automatically.
Oh, okay.
Or it has the ability to.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the sites for an example of doing that is Washington Post.
Oh, they use
really
Django.
Popular newspaper uses Django.
Oh, okay.
Pounce used to use Django before they got shut down.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Like I said, Google does the back end stuff. I mean, Google does, you can integrate Django with Google apps.
Really easily, huh?
Yep.
That's funny. I did not know Google was so hardcore for Python.
Yeah. I just saw an article recently that they're trying to rewrite actually Python, C Python, like the Python code to make it faster. And they're already way faster.
Yeah. I mean, they're probably putting tons of like summer of code money into it.
they really are. They're already trying to make, and they even said in the article, they're trying to basically use Python as a replacement for C to get it at the same speed as C.
Wow.
C code. Like, they're really trying hard with the Python thing.
Cool.
So I started using Django basically on a whim. I mean, I flipped the coin and started using it, and I like what I see so far.
Yeah. I mean, again, I like what you're kind of doing at the first, so I want to make sure we split, the language from the framework.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, a lot of that, like there's a book, and apparently it's a decent book I heard, but it's called Rails for PHP Developers. And that title bugs me because Rails is not ubiquitous to PHP. Mm-mm. You know, Rails is ubiquitous to Cake. Ruby is ubiquitous to PHP, or analogous, you know, languages. Languages and languages and frameworks and frameworks. So, I mean, you kind of talked a little bit about Ruby and Python. So I kind of want to stick with the language a little bit because we didn't talk much about Python as a language.
Okay, let's start with the language first, and then we'll go to the framework.
Okay, so language-wise, what I like about Python, I'm pretty OCD about my tabs, my indentation for my code. Which means that I think Python would be really good for me because it bases your whole code flow off of your indentation.
Yeah, that was the first thing I noticed is they don't use any closures. There's no semicolon for end of statements. What else does Ruby use? Ruby doesn't use an end statement. They just use a new line, right?
There's end statements, yeah.
Semicolon or something?
No. Oh, not end of line. No, there's no end of line character. Yeah.
Okay. Python goes above and beyond that. There's no end of loop or end of if statements.
Yeah.
It's a new line. But
the way they're able to do that is you have to tab properly or the if statements is going to be wrong.
Yeah, so I mean, I do an if statement. I say if this equals that, you know, and then I hit enter and I tab over. And so anything that's indented farther than that if statement
included in the if statement
is the if statement or right. the loop, if you did the same with the loop. And then when you're done with the loop, you just back, you know, you back out an indentation.
Right.
And that's the then it knows that's the before that was the loop. And then it just continues the code.
Yeah.
Like you'd started.
And so and if anybody's listening and saying, oh, I got to remember to tab. Well, most editors that see Python, well, most good editors that will see Python code will say, oh, this is Python. I got to behave in a certain
way. Be hardcore about your indentation and your tabs and stuff, yeah.
Vim, the editor that I use mostly for scripting language, says, you know what? This is Python. I'm not even going to let you change the tabs because, you know, well, I'm sure it probably does let you, but it would be silly because they do have very strict. For example, like to separate a class, you have to use two spaces or two lines.
Oh, okay.
For a function, it's one line between the next function. Because okay. a function doesn't have an end
yeah.
closure. So it doesn't. So the only way to say that this is the end of the function and now this is a new function is another a blank line.
Yeah. I have a feeling I should try Python because so, I'm really OCD about those sort of things anyways, formatting and stuff.
Now, so a lot of good coders will do this automatically. They'll put spaces between the functions because it looks nicer. It's easier to see that this is another function.
Easier to scan, yeah.
Python says, you know what? We're going to force them to. And I think yeah. that's why a lot of people like Python is because it forces you to have tabs. It forces you to have spaces, clear white space.
And it's one of those things that's like configuration versus convention. Like Ruby has a Ruby way. They call it the Ruby way. And you can do it, but you don't have to.
Mm-hmm.
And I almost prefer configuration where you have to do it. I mean, like this.
Right.
I mean, I would rather just take a little time and a little pain of learning the proper way to format and have it, you know, especially if you're in a company where you're going to have to, like, do other people are going to have to do maintenance or you might be passing this code right. on down. I mean, it's nice to have that instead of saying, like, well, here's a style guide for our code, which a lot of companies do anyways. But, you don't have to follow. This Python makes you. It will not run right. If you don't you know, format it correctly.
No, it will not. So it's kind of like Java. When you import stuff, you have to say import, or Perl does it too. You say use this mm-hmm. module, import, blah. Coming from a PHP background, PHP has everything built into the language.
Yeah.
Like if you need a regular expression, it's a function built into
the PHP is the kitchen sink.
You don't import. Yeah. You don't import. Stuff that you need in PHP.
Mm-hmm. You can with like pair, but
right.
that's advanced
stuff.
Well,
but most things that you need are already in the base. That's true. The base.
Like handling with data types and stuff.
Yeah. One kind of nice thing about that is you can actually import your own modules that you made. You know, it's because you're already importing modules all the time. It's just a simple, easy thing to say import this from here.
Yeah.
And you can also import what you want from that. So you can say import this. Function from this only this function from this module.
Oh wow! Kind of just on a function by function basis. That's
yeah,
cool.
Yeah, and you can name it whatever you want. So like in PHP, although you probably want to kind of keep the same names because you want to keep it simple and easy for other maintainers, but you have the option to say, you know, so like PHP, you've got a function called a certain function, and that name is that name, right?
Yeah.
If you try to use that function name. That's already taken, you're going to have a problem because it thinks it's that function. And in Python, you can name it whatever you want. So if you already have that name taken, you know, you can use that.
Wow, that's cool.
What else? What
about? Well, let's talk about the frameworks. Okay. I mean, we kind of covered the language. I mean, we've talked about Ruby enough. I don't think we really need to rehash that anymore.
Sure. Okay.
So let's talk about like Rails versus Django.
Or just Django.
Or just Django. Just Django. I mean, what do you like about it?
If I have any Rails comparison, I'll add it. One of the nice things I saw about Django was the you can document your function in the first. So the first line of the function, you can have a triple quote, and then you define the function and end the triple quote. And once you do that, it doesn't matter where you are in your program or if you're even in another file that you imported that function from. All you have to say in the interactive debugger. Is you can say define this function and it will give you that comment from there in the interactive debugger.
Nice.
So you're like, oh, I forgot what that function was. Instead of having to go back into the file, scroll down, look at the thing. You can just say define this function or whatever.
So is this similar to the sort of Rails console that I was talking about at one point?
Python does have an interactive interactive console.
That I don't know how.
Well, hold on, let me separate this a little bit. Python has an interactive console, and then Django has its own shell that is the exact same thing as the Python interactive console, but it adds your app specific stuff.
Yeah, it's the exact same as same IRB and Ruby, and then the console in Rails.
Okay,
yeah. And if I could have that in everything I developed, I would probably be the happiest guy in the world. It's just the most amazing feeling that you can go into a console. I mean, you and I are console guys anyways,
right,
and run your scripting functions and use your scripting classes to do it. I mean, like my example was I was doing something that was a Rails project, and I had to delete something from the database, and I was, you know, getting ready to fire up, you know, PHP my admin to go clear out the database. And I was like, you know, I got to go do this. And I was talking to Paul, the guy who was on the show last week, and I said, well, okay, Paul, I need you to help me make sure that when I remove these, I don't break anything else. Mm-hmm. And first thing he did was fire up the script console, and I was like, whoa, what are you doing? He's like, well, we're using Rails, dog, so get ready. And it blew my mind. I was like, oh, and he just went in there and he went like users.find, you know, with the condition that I had, and then he did mm-hmm. users.remove, which then is the remove function in the code uh-huh. that does all the other sort of, you know, other junk that might entail with removing a user that I never could have done in MySQL or would have thought of.
Right.
And it blew my mind. That's such a great way to do things.
Yeah, the console's awesome, and Django provides that just like Rails, so that's cool.
Yeah, kudos to both, because that really kind of gave me a major mind blowing. I thought that is why these things are useful. Things like that. I mean, tools like that are amazing.
Django provides a full stack, so they have a server, just like Rails, where you can just say start the server, and
that's
you've got a web
awesome.
Server. But like Rails, you probably don't want to use that server for production because they're not in the server, you know, web server business or just in the framework business.
Yeah. But that's great for development because, I mean, with PHP, if you have a Linux box, sure, you might make your own local development server. But for a lot of people I know, like at work, they just because you're a programmer does not mean you should be fit to manage a server.
True.
And so, like, we created a development server with all the user accounts and people they went to it. That's cool. But this is what's great about these is it's just a project and you say fire up the web server and you go to it. It's on a special port, you know, so you don't have to mess with it. And there it is for local development purposes. You're good to go.
Yeah. One of the downsides, I guess, for the Django being a server and being, you know, deploying it is, I guess, one of the downsides against the Rails or that's kind of a pro for the Rails is that Django is probably a slightly harder to find a host for.
Yeah.
Just because, like, I know DreamHost supports the mod, the Apache Ruby, the built-in Apache one instead
mod
of Mongrel.
Passenger.
Instead
it's
of
called Mongrel. Mod Passenger.
Yeah.
It's an Apache mod, yeah.
I think you're going to see more hosts that have the Rails built into their Apache versus the Python right now. So right now.
Yeah.
Now, you can always find a host that's going to be okay with it. Like, I know Media Temple is fine with Python. They have Django figured out, but...
Yeah, I was talking to a guy at work, and we're managing a server now, and one of the things I said was these people want the ability to do Ruby on Rails on the server as well as do some Python and PHP, and I said, well, why don't you just install Mod Passenger, and then you have PHP and Mod Python and all that stuff on. There's a Mod Python. Or maybe there is.
There is a Mod Python.
There is Mod Python. Okay.
And that's what they recommend.
And he said that they don't – he said the reason not to do that because what we're going to end up doing is like a Mongrel Apache cluster, which is a really gross way of doing it. But he said apparently those don't play well together. So like if you have a Rails server with Mod Passenger, you're fine. If you have a Python server with, you know, Mod Python, you're fine. But when you try and mix the two in the same place, I guess they don't really like each other. So I'm assuming that's maybe that's why you're having a lot of trouble doing that because...
Interesting. Well, like in Media Temple, you get a virtual, like, this is a Python environment. Like, you can set it up through the panel or whatever, but it's a Python Django environment.
Yeah.
You're not using a Ruby and Django environment. It's a Django environment. Or
yeah.
It's a Rails environment.
Yeah, exactly.
You're not using both, so...
Yeah.
So,
I mean, one thing I think that I'm glad that we both have kind of gotten to this frame of mind where we say these frameworks are good. There's good,
right.
They're good tools. Rapid development is good.
Yeah, and I'm not saying either way. I'm just Django's the one I chose by a flip of a coin.
Yeah,
and I'm learning it, and I like what I like frameworks. This is the goal you should take is if you're a PHP developer, which I was. Mm-hmm. Expand a little bit. I've learned so much from these frameworks, the way they do code, the way I'm just seeing so many cool things that I've been missing out by just being a strictly PHP scripter.
Yeah, and I mean, it was funny when I first, I'm not trying to throw stones or anything, but a lot of guys at work were using Rails, and I had to learn it. They said they wanted me to learn it for work at the time. And so I was learning it, and as we were both PHP developers, and I was kind of like talking about frameworks. And you picked a PHP framework. You want to stick with PHP. Right. That's cool. And there really isn't a PHP framework that does what Rails or Django does yet.
And mainly because PHP doesn't really have a very good interactive console and all those things. It's not a very. It's not the best language to make a framework. Like
yeah, exactly.
That.
So I remember you picked Zend as your framework for mm-hmm. PHP, and it was the reason you picked it was because it was really lightweight. I mean, it was more of a collection of useful tools than a full framework.
Exactly.
And I'm glad that we're both on the same page now, because I remember there was times where I would try to explain to you some of these cool framework things, and because you hadn't actually done it,
right.
You know, you didn't really fully understand how cool it was until you actually like get into it. And like, I mean, the second you do a console, interactive console with your project, I mean, you're just like, wow, this is awesome.
Yeah.
And it's hard to explain until you actually do it. You're like, well, you know, you're like, well, why would I want that? I could just run my PHP code. And you're like, yeah, you can. This is different. It's like, you know, like, you know. And once you actually dig into it, you're like, this is a great tool. And I'm not going to get into like, you know, Ruby versus Python, you know, Rails versus Django, because they're both awesome.
Yeah, it's just tools. Like even the Zen PHP framework is great.
Yeah.
If you're looking for a function to verify credit card numbers, it's a simple copy and paste this function and you're done with Zend.
Exactly. So I think sort of my vision of the future is going to be is that with all these rapid frameworks, I think just numbers of applications are going to explode. And the way I think they're going to explode is that I think with these development frameworks, it's easy for you or I to make a pretty full-featured web application that's, you know, very secure because you have your framework backing you. They're doing all your, you know, you're making sure you're not getting SQL injections and stuff like that. They're doing all that for you. They're doing all this input verification and stuff for you. So you can get a full, you know, a good full-featured web application in almost no time. And so I think, you know, there's going to be a lot more of these pop up. And I think you're going to see a lot more of your local businesses having really cool full-featured web applications.
Yeah, because a lot of these, you know, frameworks integrate some of the Web 2.0 stuff like Google Sitemaps and Twitter APIs. And
yeah, exactly. Oh. So I'm all for frameworks. The only problem is I haven't done much development lately, I've really fallen behind. So I hope you go the distance with Django, because I'm really curious. Here, I'm kind of in a Rails world at work, and Rails does some cool stuff, but I really kind of want to hear what the power of Django too.
I will probably end up learning Rails as well, but right now it's Django. But I think everyone should learn as many languages. I mean, I learn them both. Because you're going to see some cool thing that they do, and you're saying, oh, that's cool, I'm going to integrate. You're going to learn a lot more in your general programming that.
Yeah,
it's going to transfer all around.
Don't be a language curmudgeon. I mean, you know, we both were for a while there. I was like, why would I learn anything?
I got so,
PHP.
I'm so glad I got into all the different languages, because it really, even Perl, when I started learning Perl, I learned a lot of new stuff.
Yeah.
Regular expressions that I've never even used in PHP. Perl, first chapter of Perl is like, you need to learn regular expressions because it's awesome.
And if you don't know anything about them, go get this book and then come back and you're like, okay.
Might as well learn them right now. So
yeah.
You'll be a better programmer if you learn more stuff like this.
Yeah. And I mean, the funny thing is, I think you and I are kind of in this weird sort of ambiguous situation where we're not, I see a lot of computer scientists. And the good computer scientists I know have absolutely no hesitation in language. They're looking at concepts as opposed to just what the language is. So I mean, for people like us, if you're not like a full fledged programmer by profession, you tend to, you know, you learn your one language and you stick to it.
Right.
But it's kind of good that we're getting into that level now where instead of just sort of using PHP to get our stuff done, we're saying, okay, well, language is not that hard to learn. I mean, there's little nitpicky things about each language, but I mean, you need to look at the whole picture and come up with creative ideas using the right language for the task.
Job, yeah.
Instead of, you know, trying to shove a square PHP peg into a round, you know, Python hole.
I'm glad you mentioned that too, of how really long it takes to. Once you learn one language, one kind of computer language, you can kind of take that and apply it to another language. For example, I didn't know anything about. I'd never written a line of Python code ever before I started Django, and I feel like I know how to get around in Python already.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, or, you know, if you don't...
Within a few hours.
What you find is if you don't know how to find it...
You can search and...
Yeah, you can get the feel for it. You can go to an API and you can figure out what you need.
Like, I know enough to get in trouble. Like, you know what I'm saying?
That's always
like
a sign right
there.
I
know enough to start my app and get going and then be like, oh, how do I do this? And then go search for it, you know?
Yeah.
I'm already at that level with Python and I've never written it before.
Yeah. This, so. And that's a good development. I think a good development both mentally and professionally.
Yeah.
So... All right, well, that about does it for the show, or for this episode of Face Off. We'd like to remind all of our subscribers, or listeners, that you can subscribe to our show at faceoffshow.com/feed. If you have suggestions or comments, you can email them at studio@faceoffshow.com, reply to us on Twitter, or make a comment on our blog. We really would like if you guys do that, you know, let us know what we're doing wrong, what we're doing right, and what you'd like to hear. You know, send us an audio comment if you want or anything like that. So thanks for listening to the show, and we'll see you guys next week.